session number 9428, reel 7. Mr. Keel, Reel 7. You were describing your work as a mess caterer, and you got up to the point where you were telling me about Captain Lowenstein.
Yes. Yes, well, they seemed to wish little jobs onto me. Captain Lowenstein, he was really nothing to do with me, except that my knowledge of the language and whatnot must have been talked about in the powers that be at headquarters, the regimental headquarters, because I don't know how it came about, but they said if you can help Captain Lowenstein with some measurements or interpret for him, he's got to do some measurements of some fields where a claim has gone in, will you go and help Captain Lowenstein? That is how I got to know him. And I got friendly with him, and that was how I found that I could do little jobs that he was really his job as an officer to do, but I found that I could do it, such as going to measure up fields that had been damaged by the troops or transport. I could do that as well as he could, so he used to wish those things onto me. And most unregimental was, I think he was a little bit of a gadabout who liked to hop away from the regiment and perhaps have a day in one of the nearest towns. And he'd say, well, Keel, I believe there's some men coming for some pay. They're going on leave. Fix them up with pay and sign their pay books, because you can sign my signature, you can forge it. Most unregimental, really, what I did. But I could copy his signature. So men coming on leave would say they wanted £20 for leave. Was it £20 for leave? And so I would take their books into another room, wherever we were, or somewhere where they couldn't see me, and I would then sign their pay books, £50 or £20. That, and I would sign it D. Lowenstein. Take it back with the money and give them their pay book back, which was then signed apparently by the officer. I used to do that many, many times, most unregimental and all wrong as far as military was concerned. But there it was. I guess the swindles in every walk of life, even today.
Can you tell me how you knew how much pay was owing to those men?
Ah, well, that would come from their regiment. See, their regiment would say, when you go and leave, find the claims officer, and he has authorised to pay you out £20 or £50 or £1 or whatnot. That would be laid on by their company.
So you get the documentation through?
I would get that through, yes, to pay, authorising to pay that. And as I say, well, I paid it and swindled by signing the books. I could have made a lot of money, couldn't I? I could have paid out a lot of fictitious men, couldn't I? I didn't. No, I didn't.
To return to the another aspect of your work, apart from paying the troops, you said you dealt with claims from French farmers.
Yes.
Can you explain what happened there?
Yes, I could. It's in the fields, maybe troops had to go from A to B, and the quickest way to get from A to B was to cross that field. Well, the field was probably under cultivation, young shoots coming up, but to get there quickly, they would cross the field and ruin all the all the little bits of growing crops. Or if it was corn, they would wade their way through the corn. Well, of course, when the farmer saw it, he said, "Oh, my ruined crops, I'll claim off the British Army for that." So he would put in a claim for... I could measure in French ground things like acres and what I could... I can't now, I can't remember it.
Hectares.
But I could remember that. And I would go and measure up the ground for it. Then they would say that they wanted, we say, 50,000 francs compensation. And I would say, well, the crops hadn't grown to that extent. They couldn't, if the market value of them wouldn't be 50,000 francs, 10,000 francs would cover, we'll say, the whole of the damage done. And that's as far as the British Army was going, 10,000 francs. That I used to do off my own bat, which should have been Captain Lowenstein, but he trusted me to do that.
Did he give you any specific instructions?
No, he wouldn't. No, he'd just tell me, well, see that they don't diddle us, that's all, killed us. You know, if they say they want 50,000, tell them you're only going to give them 10. Make them accept that and then get their signature, and then that's 10,000. Or we've saved ourselves, we've saved the army 40,000 francs. That, as far as I can, I don't say it was exactly those words, but it was that, if you understand. Mm.
Did you actually know the value of a crop by looking at it? Did you?
No, I think whether he briefed me on what it would be worth, I don't know. Or how I knew it, I don't know. But apparently it worked. Whichever way I found out about it, I don't know. But it apparently worked.
Now, you're in quite an influential position, really, being a billeting officer.
I suppose.
Were you able to help other people than officers getting...
Yes. Top NCOs, they used to consider they were entitled to a decent billet. Well, naturally, a sergeant, a regimental sergeant major, he would consider himself same rank as an officer, so he would want a proper billet. Several of them, top NCOs, wanted a billet. Well, there's two little instances. One was I, naturally, clever little girl me, I always used to scrounge myself a nice little billet with proper bed and sheets and things like that. I always had that. And I know I was lying in bed early one morning when some of the boys from the barn used to come over for early morning coffee with the farmer's wife. And this particular, that's very funny, but tickled me at the time. They were North Country, evidently, boys. And this was a conversation this particular morning. Bang, bang, bang at the door. Says, oh, bonjour, madame. I said, bonjour, monsieur. He said, très bon last night, eh? Pardon? Très bon last night, eh? Ah, oui, monsieur, très bon. No bon. No, monsieur, no bon. No, très bon. Oui, monsieur, très bon. No bon. No, monsieur, no bon. No, madame. Très bon last night, eh? No bomb. Ah, je comprends, monsieur. Oui, je comprends. Yes, très bon last night, no bomb. Jerry used to bomb all around that sector, and that's what he was saying. It sounded the same. Très bon last night and no bomb. But it sounded the same. Très bon and no bomb. Sounded the same. That tickled me. And I really did some laughing in my nice bed. Talking about beds... was, and I said about top NCOs. Now, our bandmaster, we just moved it out of the, they just come out of the trenches, and he said, oh, Tommy, he said, you haven't got a spare billet for me, have you? I said, you know, there's not many places in this village, and it's been a job to squeeze in all the officers. No, I haven't got one. Oh, but he surely said, somewhere you can squeeze me in. Well, he was a nice bloke, so I said, no, I haven't got a single one. I said, but naturally, you'd think I was silly if I hadn't. I have got a very nice bedroom with a double bed. So, if you don't mind sharing the double bed, share it with me for a week we're out here. Oh, that's fine. Well, First couple of nights, quite good, yes. We shared it and slept quite comfortably. But on about the third night or something, I woke up with a funny little movement round my bottom. And I thought, oh, he's having a dream. So I sort of brushed his hand away and dropped off again. A little later, the same thing again. It happened. I felt a hand round my bottom again. And I pushed a hand away quickly and said, I don't do, come here, so and so. And he sort of muttered in his sleep, as I thought. And so I dropped off again. And this time, he'd gone much further. He was almost raping me. So I turned round in my bed and I hit him on the bed. I knocked him out of the bed. I stood him up on his feet off the floor. I punched him with my fist. I brought my elbow back the other way. I really battered his head and face for trying to bugger me. And anyway, he said to me, you know what you've done? I said, yes, I do. And you know what you've done? He said, I haven't done anything. I said, you try to bugger me. He said, I shall report this. You'll be court-martialed. I said, fine. You report it tomorrow morning and you see who wins. I said, do you know you're a top NCO? I'm a lower NCO. I said, one crime in the army is buggery, and that carries the death penalty. You would be shot if I opened my mouth because you tried to bugger me. And he never opened his mouth except to say that he'd, on his way to his billet, he'd slipped over and got gravel rash all down one side of his face. He gave that, but he never said how he got his flaming gravel rash. Well, that was it. But I never shared my bed again with another NCO or anybody. No. So I thought I'd put that in. It doesn't sound nice, but there it was. That there was. I expect everybody. Sexy. I was sorry for that bloke afterwards because everybody was sex starved. There was no such thing as girls around. And there it was. He was probably in that mood and anything was good enough. To me, I wasn't good enough. If I was good enough, I didn't want to be. That's all I can say about that.
Okay, thank you very much. Could you tell me something about how long you'd actually worked as a mess caterer in the Lions?
I should think it must have been about a year, I should think. You know, a year is a long time, isn't it?
Roughly what years would that be?
Well, 1915 we arrived in France, 1516. And the 16 was the Somme, Hohenzollern, Redoubt. 16, the end of 16. End of 16, I should think I got my mess caterer job. I should think about the end of 16. Because 17, sometime in 17, became the concert party days. So I should think I was somewhere about a year mess catering and interpreting.
As a mess caterer and interpreter, that would have taken you out of the frontline service, of course. How did you feel about being out of the front line?
Well, I say I was out of the front line. I was in, but out of the front line. I didn't sleep in the front line anymore. I didn't eat in the front line anymore, or wash, or do any of those things in the front line. But I used to go up to the front line every day and some evenings. I had to go to get my orders for officers who wanted different things for their messes or different things for their wine cellars. That is why I had to go. So I was always in and out of the trenches as far as the front line and back. So you can call it being out of the trenches, but I was never out of the trenches, if you understand, except for sleeping and eating.
Did the fact that you were taken out of the front line for a large part of the time make it actually worse going into the front line?
Not at all. No. I found things of interest nearly every time I went up.
Can you give me examples of what you
mean? Well, yes. There was one place, I think it was at Albert on the Somme, mouldy with rats, and I think I told you that I found or scrounged a riding whip that had got a metal knob to it. And somehow got or bought or scrounged an electric torch. And I used to love to wander up in the evening up to the front line. You could see a little movement in front of you. Sure enough, it was a rat. Squirt a torch on it there and wallop with the loaded whip. Knock it out. And I used to think like that, delve into shell holes, see if I could find any souvenirs. Things of interest I found. Shells coming over, bullets going crack over your head. All things of, well, I say interest. Diversions. Away from... because I knew I was going back and I could sleep in a proper bed or something when I got back. I didn't have to sleep in the flaming trench in the muck and the dirt and lice.
You say that was the one major advantage of your new job?
That was the main part. Also, as I say, I'm certain I ate much better because I could buy things. When I could buy for the officers and the men's canteens, I wouldn't actually buy myself anything that I wanted.
Did you actually feel safer now in your new job? Less in personal danger?
Yes, I rather think I did. If I was conscious of it, I would know that when I'd been up to the front line for orders, that I would be going back to the base, which was either a village or wherever it was. It would have been a village or small town. I knew that when I got back there, I would be very much out of danger compared with I would in the front line. Because naturally the enemy is going to smash your front line and smash any troops that they could get at with their bombs and whatever it is. They would do that to the front line, support lines and reserve lines. But whereas when you're way back some little way, you felt safer because those things didn't happen to the extent that they did in the front line. No, I felt better out of the line in. But I didn't mind going up to the front line. I always found things of interest.
Yes, when you went up to the front line, was that always at night or during the day?
As I say, mostly daytime, but I think it was more it would be evening time, because I would get my orders in the evening time, because I'd have to be free to start off for whatever this EFC canteen was, which means I'd have to start off in the morning. So I got a feeling that I must have got up the line in the evening to get my orders, to leave myself free to start out with my horse and cart the next morning. Yes, it would have been evening time that I would go up the line more. I think so, because back to where a little while ago when I said about I used to love to knock rats out. Well, of course, they were in the dark and I was using a torch. And so it must have been going up the line in the evening. And of course, it would be quieter in the evening going up to the front line than it would be in daylight. Yes, that's it. So you can figure that out of the trenches, I was happier than I was in the trenches.
Right, thank you very much. Could you now move on to the concert part of your career, and perhaps start off by telling me how you came to be in the concert party?
Oh, yes. It was whichever sector it was we were in, it must have been around Béthune, B-E-T-H-U-N-E, Béthune, well-known French town. And there was a theatre at Béthune, and I happened to pass it when I was catering, and I thought, and it said, the Ace of Spades concert party. Oh, I thought, concert party? I'd never seen anything like that. So I made it my business to go and see this show in the evening or afternoon, whenever it was playing. And, oh, boy, I was back to my pre-army days. It was a proper stage and lights and costumes. people performing and singing and dancing. I was thrilled. Oh, I thought if I could only get with something like that. So I made it my business to go backstage and tell them how much I enjoyed their show and would there be any possibility of joining a show like this? And they said, well, what do you do? I said, well, I don't do anything like song or dance. The only thing is that I have, before the war, doubled females, and I did riding parts for Drury Lane Theatre and other places and touring with other shows, but always with horses and doubling females. I said, I make up really well as a girl. So they said, yes, we could do with another girl. We'll have you. So I make application to join us. I did, was turned down flat. They said I couldn't join them, my regiment said. He said, you're too valuable. Same thing happened in the Second War. You're too valuable in the job that you're doing as caterer, interpreter, and whatnot. No, we're sorry. Application refused. Of course, I was heartbroken about that until some long time. I used to go. Sometimes the concert party would let me know in some way that a show they were putting on called for two girls. And I would sometimes then go and act in this thing for a night or two until that play came off. But I couldn't join it.
Before you actually joined the concert.
Before I actually full time joined it, yes.
How could you get the time off from doing your other job?
Oh, well, I could make my own time off of catering. I wasn't told, go there now, come back now. I could make my own times. I was free agent. But I couldn't leave my job.
Mm-hmm. How did you come to get to be a full-time member of the concert party?
Yes, that's a story, but I told you some time ago that I got a feeling I never got preferential treatment, except I think I was looked on with a more kindly eye by the powers that be, because I was one of the original members of my battalion. As I told you, my number on joining on August the 14th, 1914, my number was 478. So I got a feeling that being an old warrior, whether they looked on me or that, I think I got a little bit of preferential treatment. But anyway, I tried to join this concert party and they said, no, Keel, you're much too valuable on the job that you're doing. Sorry, refused. I was so upset about that that one day, walking through a village, there was a sort of little cavalcade, and I noticed it was the general officer commanding 12th Division, which I knew his name, of course you would know his name. His name was General Scott. And an NCO or a junior officer wouldn't approach the commanding general without getting first permission to do so. But little cheeky me, I thought this might be my big time, my big chance. So I walked over to the general, who was sitting on horseback, and I saluted smartly and told him the story that my name is Corporal Keel, sir. I'm in the Middlesex Regiment. I am a mess caterer. I do interpreting. In the civil life, I was on the stage. I was a jockey. And I used to double females. I said, the concert party, which I don't know whether you've seen, he said, oh, yes, very good, Keel, very good one. I said, well, sir, what I have been offered by the concert party to join them to act as girl in it, but my regiment won't release me. They say I'm too valuable in the job I'm doing. They won't release me, sir. But I would love to be with the concert party full time. Could you help me, sir? I said, a most unusual thing for a corporal to ask a general officer commanding. If you could help, sir, I could bless you for the rest of my life, which I have done. And I didn't think much would come of it for some time, but to my amazement, when I got to my battalion in the evening, there it was, the order, Corporal Keel will join forthwith the 12th Divisional Concert Party. he must have got to work straight away when he got back to his headquarters. That was the story of the concert party and how I became a member of it.
Did that mean that you changed your unit at that point?
Oh, no. No. No, nothing like that. Whatever job you did, once you were enlisted into your regiment, nothing, whatever, wherever you went, could alter that. I would still be, whatever happened, I would still be Lance Corporal Keel of the Middlesex Regiment. The only thing is that the Middlesex Regiment, when they detached me to join the concert party, when they detached me, it meant that they were one man short in the battalion, which didn't mean a sausage, except they were one man short, which means that they would have to import another man, if you like, to take my place or to bring up the numbers. Probably 2 or 3 dozen went. But anyway, I was detached from my 11th Middlesex Regiment and sent to a holding, or transferred to a holding battalion, which I never saw, but it was still Middlesex Regiment, but the holding battalion was the 23rd Middlesex. And I didn't know that until a long time after, when I had some papers came through and it said Lance Corporal Keel of the 23rd Middlesex Regiment. I thought, I'm not 23rd Middlesex. And then, of course, I found out that it was a holding battalion that I had to belong to. And that, on my discharge papers, shows 23rd Battalion. But the 23rd Battalion was never a complete battalion. It was never a fighting battalion. It was a holding battalion that, if you joined today, you would be sent to the 23rd. And then, when you're qualified as a proper soldier, you would probably be transferred to the 11th Middlesex Regiment. That is the way you would become that. But you would start off as 23rd.
Would all members of the concert party be in the same battalion?
They, no, because they're all different regiments. No. There were only two of us in the Middlesex in the concert party. No, there were gunners. I can't remember what they're on the regiment.
Okay.
Not unless I looked at their pictures. If they're in uniform, I could tell by the cap badge which regiments they were. But it really didn't make any difference. They were just people, mm-hmm. as far...
Well, perhaps we could now look at the actual organisation of the concert party, beginning with perhaps the man in charge and working down, seeing what different jobs
yes.
they had.
Well, of course, with the concert party, even though you're, whatever, we're 10, 15 or 20 strong with the orchestra, it's like a small unit where you've got the powers that be in that small unit as you would with a big unit. For instance, we were the concert party, so as we were a detached thing, you had to have an officer. An officer must be at the head of a detachment, and you've got to have NCOs. Well, we had NCOs because they were part of the they were performers, so we didn't have to import them, but we had to have an officer. And our officer that got that job was a very good musician, Royal Academy of Music, and he was the one who would arrange all the band parts and music for the concert party.
What was his name?
So Howe, Lieutenant Howe.
And who would be his immediate subordinates?
The next to him would have been Staff Sergeant Hammersley, who was a very good actor in civil life. Well, he was the NCO in charge, as far as we let him be in charge, if you understand. But he was like the next. He would do...